Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Joshua Rothman about his new book, The Ledger and the Chain, How Domestic Slave Traders Shaped America. Joshua Rothman is professor of history and chair of the Department of History at the University of Alabama. He's the author of two prize-winning books, Flush Times and Fever Dreams, and Notorious in the Neighborhood. We're speaking to him today about his stunning new book, The Ledger and the Chain, How Domestic Slave Traders Shaped America. Josh Rothman, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Sus. Thanks for having me.
This is the story of three men who formed the largest slave trading enterprise in the United States, Isaac Franklin, John Armfield, and Rice Ballard. So tell us a little bit about them and the years you spent in researching their lives.
So Franklin, Armfield, and Ballard were the partners in a company that anyone who reads about the domestic slave trade will come across, and it was known as Franklin and Armfield. They operated from about 1828 until 1836. They had headquarters in Alexandria. They bought enslaved people all throughout the Chesapeake, sent them mostly by ship down the Atlantic coast, up through the Gulf of Mexico, into New Orleans. Some were sold there. Some were then shipped further up the Mississippi to Natchez in Mississippi. And over the course of their career in the slave trade, the company sold roughly 10,000 enslaved people to the Lower South, mostly into cotton and sugar plantations in the Lower South. I spent a lot of time thinking about these men and their business. The book took me probably about 8 years to do the research and the writing in total, and it archivally took me all over the place. I spent a lot of time in New Orleans, but I was in Mississippi, I was in Virginia, I was in Tennessee. I looked at archives as far afield as even places like New Jersey. The records of the business are sort of scattered all over the country.
Now, these men were successful for a number of reasons. I mean, some of it was raw nerve. Some of it was native sense of cruelty. They had good relationships with the banks and kept that going. And they enveloped smaller slave trading enterprises and folded them into theirs. And finally, later, they owned their own ships.
They did. All of those things are true. Ultimately, probably if you had to sort of pin down one factor that made them maybe most successful, and that really, in some ways, enabled all the other things, enabled them to buy the ships, enabled them to put smaller traders out of business and so on, was their access to credit, to money. Isaac Franklin, in particular, developed relationships with many bankers and merchants in the Lower South, particularly in New Orleans, which was kind of the banking capital of the Lower South. And by having access to credit, he had money at his disposal almost at all times.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a tricky operation because he's borrowing money and loaning money and trying to collect money and then send money back to the Upper South. But really, the capacity to kind of keep money and enslave people both in constant motion is really what enables the business to become so powerful.
Well, there's a certain element of suspense when somebody defaults on a promissory note, you know?
Yeah.
They're having this paper flow throughout the company. It's really fascinating economic reading.
It's hard to make economic reading fascinating, so I'm glad you're
no. I did. They took that on faith. I mean, really. Now, New Orleans is such a big part of this story, and they did so much business, and so much of it was with prominent New Orleanians. It seems like bank presidents bought a lot of slaves. Public entities like the Public Works Board ran on slave labor as well. So a lot of your time must have been tracking that legacy down.
Yeah, you know, I spent the best way to track the customer base of Franklin and Armfield in New Orleans, of course, is through the notarial records. So I spent a fair amount of time at the notarial archive compiling a database of, I think all told, it's about 2,500 slave sales. And one of the most amazing things to me was not simply the range of people and locations that Franklin and Armfield sold to. I mean, they sold to all the people you mentioned, obviously, and they sold to slaveholders in parishes kind of throughout lower Louisiana and even up into the cotton district several hundred miles away. But one thing that always struck me, and it's funny that you mentioned prominent New Orleanians, every day I would leave the notarial archives and I'd go, you know, walking through the Central Business District in the French Quarter, and I would drive around the city, and so many of the streets in New Orleans
are named
after people whose names appear in the slave trading archives. It both had a tremendous impact on me sort of psychologically, and it was also a little disorienting. It made the history that I was researching feel very present in a way that I'm not usually accustomed to when I do research.
There are a lot of physical remnants of their legacy here in New Orleans and Louisiana, too.
You know, the physical infrastructure is something that hasn't really survived that much. None of the original buildings and things like that where they worked out of are still there. But certainly many of the locations they're not hard to track down. The city did put in a marker at the corner of Esplanade and Royal, just on the Marigny side of Esplanade. Currently, it's a parking lot, but at the time, it was a house that Isaac Franklin used as a slave trading compound, and many other traders used it both before and after him. There are plenty of places really scattered on, particularly on either side of the French Quarter, both upriver and downriver, that were at one point or another slave trading locations. Banks's Arcade was a popular slave trading location by the time you got to the late antebellum period. So if you know what you're looking at and you know what you're looking for, you can find locations for it really scattered throughout the city. That's absolutely true.
And the state as well. I mean, you look at Angola Plantation, of course.
Sure. Any place where you're visiting a plantation, at some point or another, that place was the site of the slave trade as well.
Now, I have to say, one of the most arresting moments in this book is that description of a slave coffle as it was observed by a geologist named George Featherstonehoff crossing a river in Virginia. I wonder if you'd describe that scene, and I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about writing that.
So that is a moment in the late summer of 1834. And Franklin and Armfield, as I said before, they mostly sent people by ship, but at the end of every summer, they would send a caravan of enslaved people, which is known as a coffle. They would send it overland, which is really kind of the familiar image people have in their mind when they think about the domestic trade, right? They either think of auctions or they think of those images of kind of long lines of people being walked hundreds of miles across the continent.
And this one was particularly large, wasn't it?
It's enormous. So this one had 300 people in it. And I go into detail in the book about why this particular one was larger than usual. There were reasons for it that I won't get too derailed by getting into. But in most cases, we really don't have a good sort of first-person account, either from the enslaved or from traders, of what this sort of looked like, how it operated, you know, the encounters with the traders themselves. But this was an instance where this geologist and his son, they had just been named the first U.S. geologist by the federal government, and they were actually on their way to Arkansas, and they're traveling through southwestern Virginia, and they came across, really, in the woods on the stagecoach, this caravan of people who were getting ready to pick up and walk for the day, and they see 300 people, and you know, it's dawn, it's really early in the morning, and people are sitting around fires and kind of, you know, getting the wagons together because there some people walked, but people who couldn't walk and children in particular were put in wagons. Slave traders are watching them do this. They're armed. They are on horseback. And Featherstone was sort of fascinated by this. he really is almost sort of intrigued by the logistics of it. It was really complicated to get 300 people all up, all in chains, all in line, and then have them walk a couple hundred yards across the river. You know, it was late summer, so the river is relatively low, but it's still very dangerous. There's still a current. You could fall. But I think in some ways what really drives this geologist is he's not only sort of finds the process of moving all these people, he finds it interesting, but he also finds it sort of repellent. Mm-hmm. But he really is sort of intrigued by the figure of the slave traders themselves, and particularly by John Armfield, who is one of the partners in this company and happens to be accompanying this particular coffle. And so he goes into a lot of detail about the movement of the coffle, but then he goes into detail about his encounters with Armfield himself. And it's really, the source material is just so rich that it really, unlike sometimes when you're researching a subject like this, it really provided a lot of material for what I hope came across as a very sort of detailed and rich narration of what this looked like and what Armfield sounded like and what the conversations were between them on the stagecoach and things like that.
And in the background, always the sheer mass of humanity moving across the country. It's just,
yeah,
it's stunning to read about.
Yeah, I mean, they're walking people effectively from Alexandria, Virginia to Natchez, Mississippi. It took months.
Mm-hmm.
Every day they get up, they're walking 10, 15, sometimes 20 miles. It's early September. It's still really hot, even in the mountains. It's absolutely grueling and almost unimaginable to think how people did this. You know, it's not always the same people doing it, but even to do it once, it's horrific.
And also, you write a great length about the brutal sexual underpinnings of slavery. And these men were no stranger to that and were participants in that.
They were indeed. The sexual exploitation of enslaved women, the rape of enslaved women, there's nothing new about that. Anyone who's familiar with American slavery knows how endemic that is to slavery and how it's used systematically by slaveholders. But what I talk about in the book is how these slave traders, they not only are participating in what is popularly known as the fancy trade, right, selling enslaved women purely for sexual exploitation, but how these slave traders, they also participate in the exploitation of these women. They joke about it amongst themselves. I think there's really nothing else in the book that illustrates both sort of the depravity of the men and the trade, but also how that depravity is part of what kind of helps make the business work. These were men who didn't see each other all that often in person, right? You know, Armfield's in Alexandria, Rice Ballard is usually in Richmond, Isaac Franklin is usually in Natchez or New Orleans. And so the only way that they can kind of keep their relationship going is through letters. They're really writing to each other and communicating to each other. And some of what helps bond them across the distance are these sort of really kind of filthy, disgusting jokes about enslaved women. That, I think, is something that will surprise even people who are familiar with slavery, even though I suspect that almost everyone will find it extraordinarily disturbing, as they should, because it is.
Well, it is. You know, the letters are a great gift to an historian to understand how this worked. But also, that must have been exhausting to spend time with this coarse language, this terrible humor, this sense of entitlement. I mean, it is very disturbing to read.
Disturbing to read. It was hard to write about. And yes, it was hard to live with. I really, you know, I've spent a long time working on the history of slavery. Like you said at the outset, I've written other books about slavery. I'm accustomed to dealing with things that are pretty dark and pretty disturbing and you know, full of violence and exploitation and all the other things that made slavery work. But I have to be honest, this book was a challenge at a whole other level, and really one that I don't think I entirely anticipated when I started the project. I hope that won't dissuade readers. I still think the material is extremely important, but I know that it's very challenging to try to kind of get your mind around it. Thank you.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Joshua Rothman, author of The Ledger and the Chain, How Domestic Slave Traders Shaped America. One of the things that keeps you going as a reader is that you never forget the humanity at stake in all this. And you bring that through very clearly.
So I actually had to dial that back a bit. You know, when I first presented some of this material, you know, I tried out sort of how am I going to write about this?
Mm-hmm.
What's the right tone to strike? What kind of material do you put in? You don't want to sort of replicate the violence and the exploitation by seeming to exploit it for the sake of being sensational, but you also don't want to shy away from what it was. And when I got started on it, I tried out sort of one piece of writing and shared it at a workshop. And a lot of people who read it the first time said it was too much. Not too much that they were sort of put off by it, but too much in the sense that they really didn't think it was entirely necessary to really sort of fully express my own moral outrage. They felt that, like, if you present the material effectively, the horrors of all of this, the nastiness of all of it, the moral depravity of all of it, it will speak for itself. And so I hope I struck the right tone there. I ultimately was convinced by that. At first I resisted that because I felt like, you know, one of the only ways I could deal with this material was to express just how outrageous I thought it all was. But the more I thought about it, the more I felt like it was really important to let the material speak a little bit more for itself, to pick my moments where I really wanted to drive the point home. And I think, as you say, always to remember the humanity of the people on the other side. I try to bring in the voices and the experience of the enslaved themselves whenever it was possible. I never wanted the reader to forget when they were reading this book who was on the other side of all this, and the fact that they did not go willingly, that people fought back in every way they could, every time they could.
You talked to some of the descendants of these three. So what was that like?
Franklin and Armfield both, neither one of them have direct living white descendants. John Armfield and his wife never had any children. Isaac Franklin and his wife did have children, but none of them lived to adulthood. But John Armfield did raise the children of some of Franklin's nieces and nephews as his own. And I go through the book of how exactly that happened, but effectively, the people who are descendants of those nieces and nephews, and sometimes people who are descendants of other members of Isaac Franklin's family, they were people who I sort of reached out to in the course of doing my research. And I did so hesitantly because I didn't know sort of how that would go. But I think I would leave it mostly to them to talk about how that feels from their end of things. All I can say is that I know that for some of them, this is really, really hard to kind of live with and understand and try to feel sort of what is their responsibility, being that this is sort of their ancestry. But I know one thing that they did was they were extraordinarily generous with me, with their time, with conversations, occasionally with research materials. My sense from all of them is that they know that this is a burden that is theirs to bear, and they want to figure out how best to handle that burden and be responsible for that history. What that looks like, I think, is really something that they'd be better placed to speak about than I am.
Sure. So talk a little bit about what are the rewards of this writing? You've devoted your whole professional life to writing about slavery. So what is it that keeps you going through all this? And what do you hope readers take away from this?
So that's a good question. I think, you know, when I first became interested in slavery, really in graduate school, I think what attracted me to it at first was, in some ways, I just find this is going to sound sort of perverse in a way, maybe it is, but the sort of the ways that inhumanity can manifest itself is something that I just sort of find inherently interesting. Troubling, something that I sort of see as kind of a human problem that we need to sort through. We're never going to fix it, I don't think, given the nature of people. But it's something that I really wanted to devote a lot of time to think about and try to figure out for myself. But I also think that this is a history in particular that even as the country and many Americans want to know more about this history and want to figure out what it means for us today, what its legacies are, what the real story of the American past is, it's remarkable to me, even though we have so many historians and so many even sort of popular authors who write about slavery, talk about slavery, it seems like slavery is sort of everywhere in public life, there's still so much that many people don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how many times in the course of researching this book I would tell people what I was working on, and they would ask me questions about Africa. And that was because they didn't actually know that there was a domestic trade. It never really occurred to them to think about it. It wasn't something they were taught about. You know, once it was brought up, they were like, oh, right, of course, that must have been what happened. So I think in some ways what keeps me going on a project like this is that it's a story that, even though it's sort of familiar to scholars, I think it does remain kind of largely untold. And it's something that feels like, I think to most Americans, both unfamiliar and I think we sort of still live with some of the myths about the slave trade, that it really wasn't that common. It wasn't really something that was all that important. It wasn't something that slaveholders really engaged in all that much. But if you actually look at the history of the domestic slave trade, it's everywhere. It's everywhere all the time. It's a constant threat to enslaved people. It entails enormous amounts of money that are flowing throughout the country. And I, you know, for however challenging it is for me to research and to write, and I think probably for some people to read, I don't think that we do ourselves any favors by shying away from stories just because they're hard.
And the other thing is that no matter how much you think you know, it's so much worse. You know, it's so shocking, and the reality is so brutal. And this book reveals that in the most compelling kind of way.
Well, thank you, I think.
I know, it's hard to say.
But I think you're right. I mean, there were stories that didn't make it into the book. And there were things that you know, when I was doing my research, I'd come across something in the archives. And like you said, I've been working on this kind of material for 25 years, and yet I would still come across things in the archive, and I just had to get up and step away for a minute. Every time you think you've seen, you know, not just sort of the how bad is it, but how many different ways can this system work?
Mm-hmm.
How many different ways can people be brutalized and exploited and mistreated, and how many different ways can people on the other side sort of benefit from all this and go on with it day after day as if it's not a problem? Every time you think you've seen all of it, you see something else, and it shines a whole new light on it. And surely the things that are in my book are not nearly exhaustive. This is why we keep looking. It's why we keep telling the story.
Well, you know, people always ask me what I'm reading, and I'm like, and I always, and I'm trying to explain this book to people. And how I would read a bit, and then I'd have to put it down for a bit, and then I'd pick it up again. But I felt like it was a necessary book, you know, a necessary and useful book for people.
You know, when people tell me they picked it up and they're reading it, I never tell people I hope you enjoy the book.
Right.
I think that I could, but it sounds weird. What I always tell people is that I hope you find it worth your time, because I know it's hard. I know it's not the kind of book you come away saying, I really enjoyed that. What I really hope is that you feel like I did the story justice, that it was a good read and a good narrative, and that it really was worth the time that you put in to sit with something that isn't the easiest thing to sit with.
And best of all, you might find yourself changed or educated.
That would be ideal. That's a dream for a historian. Yeah.
Well, you've worked hard and it shows. We've been talking with Josh Rothman, whose new book is The Ledger and the Chain, How Domestic Slave Traders Shaped America. You can hear him discuss his work in a virtual conversation with Aaron Greenwald of the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, Thursday, May 20th at 6. To register, go to leh.org. Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Blue Cypress Books presents a socially distant sidewalk signing with comedy writer Jen Spira, author of Big Time Stories, Friday, May 14th from 2 to 3:30. Eddie Tebby signs Sorbonne Funk, Living Life in the Key of Triumph, at a socially distant book signing Saturday, May 15th from 2 to 3:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Katie Simpson-Smith will be the guest for a virtual happy hour, Monday, May 17th at 5, sponsored by Garden District Bookshop. Joshua Rothman discusses his new book, The Ledger and the Chain, How Domestic Slave Traders Shaped America, in a virtual conversation with Aaron Greenwald of the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. That's Thursday, May 20th at 6. To register, go to leh.org. Blue Cypress hosts a virtual event featuring Risa Dickens and Amy Torok of the Missing Witches podcast, Thursday, May 20th from 7:30 to 8:30. Tickets required and available via Eventbrite. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.